Today is the 8th of December, and in Japanese tradition, it is the day of the Buddha's enlightenment. So all over the world, wherever they practice Zen, they have a week around this time. They have what they call the Rohatsu retreat, where Domyo's gone. It's a week-long, really intense retreat, emulating and celebrating the Buddha's awakening. So, happy Rohatsu Day. Anyway, I just want to like give a brief, my talk is like all over the place because I was kind of left it till last minute. But then when I remembered it was Rohatsu, the enlightenment, I just wrote a little bit about that. And I just wrote that like the story of Prince Siddhartha's transformation into the Buddha is described unforgettably in Zen literature. The prince had spent years trying different spiritual practices before he decided to stop looking outside of himself for answers and instead turned the light and shone it inwards. Then his body and mind fell away and his original face was manifest. Well, most of you would recognize that's from Dogen, right? When he instructs us to in Fuka Zazengi, that's the instructions for Zazen, he said, if you sit like the Buddha sat, take the light and shine it inwards, your body and mind will fall away and your original face will manifest. What is that original face? I think that's something that we all have to kind of intuit for ourselves. Experience it for ourselves, and then with that experience, live in the world having had that transformation. That is the ideal Zen path. So that's what the story is. So I just was thinking about the night in Bodh Gaya in India when the Buddha sat under this Bodhi tree, and I wrote, it had been an intense night for Shakyamuni. Sitting on a tuft of grass, he sat very still through all the watches of the night, and he withstood the machinations of Mara, the tempter. Mara is the symbol of the Buddha's own great doubt and insecurities, which assailed him again and again, trying to weaken his resolve. So Mara is just us, like, we are the Buddha and we are the Mara. Just similarly, even though Buddha had spent so many years trying different spiritual practices, and every time he did a spiritual practice with a teacher, they said, well, I've taught you everything I know. Now you can teach with me. But he wasn't satisfied. And so he said, I'm going to sit and turn the light inwards to figure out what's true for me. And so, but then Mara came. You know, I mean, there's stories about Mara and all the hordes of different armies he brought to tempt the Buddha with, promises of power, of pleasure, of like, and who do you think you are that you are going to find the end of suffering? Like doubt. We all have that. And what is encouraging to someone like me is that even after so much arduous practice and this desire to seek the truth, so he left his family and his comforts, he still gets plagued with doubt, right? So the Buddha got Mara. However, Mara was no match for the great determination of Siddhartha, who was determined to find the cause and end to suffering. Do you know there's a statue of the Buddha where he's sitting and then he points to the earth with one hand, because Mara says, get off that seat. You don't deserve to sit there. And then the Buddha, it's like the lion's roar, he pointed to the earth and said, the earth is my witness. I have a right to sit here. The earth is my witness. And so I just like all these stories about the Buddha because, you know, they're just inspiring me. But then what happened is, as the night lightened into day, so there are three things that Zen says you need to have to practice. One of them is great doubt, which the Buddha had, of course, because he was, Mara was assailing him. And then, but he had great determination. I'm going to sit through this no matter what, right? Some people say it was one night, some people say 6 years, some say eons, who knows? But he sat there. So great determination. And then, as the night lightened into day, great faith dawned on the Buddha. It was dawn, he looked up and saw the morning star. His heart, soft and malleable from his night of Zazen, he felt a deep kinship with the star and with the whole world. And the first words he uttered were, I am awakened together with the whole of the great earth and all its beings. The amazing truth of interconnectedness dawned in his consciousness just as outside the dawn lit up the world. This truth of interconnectedness is his gift to us on this day, the 8th of December, a truth that we can realize for ourselves. Now, how do we do that? At this point, I want to talk about Zazen. I want to talk about, every time Domya asks me to lead a discussion, I'll say, I can get an article, but I want to talk about where I am in my practice. If it helps anybody, that's good. It helps me because it makes me really evaluate where I am and what's important to me. And I thought, like, if I spoke from my heart, maybe that would resonate. So then I wanted to say that, so the Buddha gave us this gift and says, you can realize this truth of oneness yourself. How do we do this? The teachings ask us to follow the precepts and practice Zazen. Now, what makes both of these practices possible is something that's called mindfulness or awareness. Mindfulness, to me, is a mistranslation, I think, from the original Pali. Because when I first heard of mindfulness, it was like, it made a little sense, but when I actually sat, mindfulness didn't seem to do it for me because it was too disembodied. Like mindfulness, you're using your cognitive faculties to pay experience, to pay attention to experience, right? It didn't get me anywhere. So then I remembered that Zen, Shikantaza, any kind of Zen is actually a body practice. It is first and foremost a body practice. That's why the Buddha sat on that tuft of grass and he didn't move. And that's why we have clear instructions for how to sit. It's not like, oh, you can just sit, do anything and pay attention with your mind. No, you have to have a certain posture. So when we sit Zazen, we are instructed to take a certain posture, keep our spines erect, and hold our hands in the cosmic mudra, which is, you know, like this. And in Fuka Zazengi, Dogen is very explicit about how we should hold our bodies. So you all know, if you come on Tuesday, we read this often. At your sitting place, spread out a thick mat, put a cushion on it, sit in the full lotus or half lotus, and it's very clear. In the full lotus, put your left foot on your right thigh. In the half lotus, simply place your left foot on your right thigh. And then I'm skipping here, and then you place your right hand on your left leg. See how precise the instructions are with what to do with your body. Straighten your body and sit upright. leaning neither left nor right, neither forward nor backward. Line your ears with your shoulders and your nose with your navel. Rest the tip of your tongue against the front of the roof of your mouth with teeth together and lips shut. Always keep your eyes open and breathe softly through the nose. So sitting is bringing awareness to the body, to the breath, and trying as best as you can to maintain it there, right? So gradually, when we do that, we get a sense of what it means to be alive, what it means to inhabit this body, really inhabit this body and be here, because we are always here, of course, but in a way we are not. Most of the time we are not. So when we do this, we sit, our faculties are wide open and alert. Shadows pass before our eyes. Sounds rise and fall. We feel the pressure of our sitting place. With our attention directed towards our physical experience, our mind slowly quiets down, and it becomes more difficult to draw boundaries between ourselves and the world around us. There would be no light without our eyes to see it, no bird sound without our ears to hear, no sensations without our bodies to feel them. No morning star without the Buddha to see it. So, the sense of how we are really not separate from the world is something we can discover when we sit wholeheartedly in our bodies. Because everything that arises at the same time as our consciousness of it. Like otherwise, it wouldn't exist for us. So we're co-creating a world at the same time that we are sitting, which I guess is one of the truths that the Buddha experienced under that tree. And as we sit grounded in our bodily experience, we may find our hearts opening up and softening. I think that it happens for me sometimes, that when I'm really, really sitting, I feel there's a softness, like the Buddha had, like this, what he called malleability. And then in Japanese, the word for mind is shin, which means heart mind. So shin, to be aware with shin means to be aware with your whole being. That's why I think mindfulness is a wrong translation. It could be like heart mindfulness, you know, that would be more. So that these are the things that I have used to help me to get more centered. So centering our attention in our heart area helps us to combine present moment awareness with an open acceptance of all that we experience. We are less inclined to resist phenomena as they arise or to get lost in stories about them. So there was an interesting article I would read, like, I don't know, two or three times. There's this woman, it's about this woman that has a lot of suffering. She has cancer and she, you know, fighting cancer and all this stuff. Like, she gets cancer over and over again. One day she has the realization that if she didn't resist fear as she was sitting on the cushion, she could reach a place of peace even with her diagnosis and the dire prognosis. So she ran to the teacher and had Dokusan with him and said, "Oh my God, the Heart Sutra was right. So it says, without hindrance, there is no fear. So if I don't hinder what's coming up, if I don't push against it, then I get a freedom." And that's what I experienced. You know, like, it's easier said than done, because our natural tendency is to push unpleasant things away. But that's why we have to practice, is for years and years it comes up and you train to see it just that is. And for me, if I center my attention to my heart, it's easier to let it come and let it go. It just, or just like, okay, here again, be gentle with it, be kind to it. The heart helps with that. My Zen practice has mostly been a practice of opening and feeling my heart. And I sometimes think, I told Omyo, I sometimes think enlightenment is nothing but when you have a really wide open heart. It's nothing else than that, right? So so it says, because we do that, instead, we tend not to get carried away by our stories. And because these stories separate us from the world and from other people, and they are often the cause of our suffering. Of course, we all know that, right? I mean, we all know that for a fact, that if we are not here, but in the past or the past or the future, you know, that's what the cause of suffering really is. Because right now, in the present moment, nothing is missing. We have all that it takes. We have that body. We have the breath. We have heartfulness to really appreciate our life. But when we make stories, of course, everything goes haywire. So so instead of making up stories, when we meet the world with heart awareness, there is an immediacy of encounter, of my heart meeting the heart of whatever is arising at that moment. This is what Dogen meant when he said that after settling into the Zazen posture, think non-thinking. So, Dogen has all these elaborate instructions about how to put your cushion and how to do this, and then all he says is, and then think non-thinking. What is non? Think not thinking. Not thinking? What is that? Non-thinking. So that is what I call heartfulness. So you are before thinking, you are beyond thinking, you are the face before your parents were born. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it's hard to have words for these things, but it's the ineffable. It's before self is made, right? It's just, it's not, it's just this and the experience of this. There's no me, right? That is the encounter that I was talking about, which brings a lot of peace and joy. But for me, at least, they're very few and far between. But the fact that it can happen is what keeps me on my cushion, you know, because I feel intuitively, yes, that is true. Before anything comes up in our minds, before any stories, there's just, like, it's like when you see someone smile at you, you smile back. You don't even think about not smiling. When someone extends a hand out, you hold their hand. That is before thinking. That is Buddha nature. That is, and then because of our conditioning, the whole world is like, that pure moment is gone, right? We come back over and over and over again. And I really think that sometimes when I doubt my practice, I doubt myself, I say to, so that's again, the conditioning that overlay my direct experience of that person or of that flower, or of that, you know, it's just like, oh, no, I didn't feel it. I'm not a kind person, you know, but really, when that person smiled, didn't you smile back? You didn't think about it. That, I think, is Buddha nature. It's nothing really mysterious or otherworldly. It's simple. Like, there is a koan when somebody asks the teacher, like, what is Buddha? And he answers, the ordinary mind is Buddha. Like, what's ordinary mind? What is, and I think that's what ordinary mind is. It's a mind that's unencumbered by what he says is grasping and aversion. It's just, you know, that mind. So that's what I think the Buddha was talking about. And I just want to say that This meaning of mind and mind, which I think is Buddha nature, and which I think it's helpful to have the heart involved in it. I should say heart and heart. There's a story about, you guys might have heard the story about the Buddha. This is a Zen story. You won't find it in Theravada traditions and stuff, but it's our tradition. So the Buddha was sitting on Vulture Peak, which is a little hillock in a state of Bihar in India. So he was sitting there, and there were lots and lots of monks assembled to hear the words of the Great One. And the Buddha was sitting, and some of his senior monks were sitting right in front of him. And then the Buddha was meditating, and then he came out of meditation. You know this story, right? He took a flower and he held it up. And everybody says, what the heck? Like, we're waiting for his words. He just hold up a flower. Mahakashya, whose name we recite, saw the flower and he smiled. He just smiled. So the Buddha said, I possess the true Dharma eye, the marvelous mind of Nirvana, the true form of the formless, the subtle Dharma gate that does not rest on words or letters, but is a special transmission outside of the scriptures. This I entrust to Mahakashya. Now, this special transmission outside of the scriptures is actually a reference to the Buddhism that got transformed when it came from India to China. So in Indian Buddhism, it was very dialectical, the Buddhist philosophy. There was a lot of, it's this, but it's not this, it's both this, and it's not this. And, you know, it's like there was a lot of philosophical argumentation, and then people would prove their... When it came to China, you know, Taoism was in China at that time, which was like really bare bones, simple, experience this right now. So that influenced all that stuff. And so Bodhidharma, who was an Indian monk who came to China to teach, he said, I'm going to teach this kind of Buddhism, which is a transmission outside the scriptures. It's this mind-to-mind transmission. You know, that's why in our tradition, when someone becomes a teacher, it's not like their teacher says, okay, tell me, okay, what does the Buddha mean by the Four Noble Truths? What does he mean by dependent origination? The teacher sees something in the student, says, he's got it, you know, that heart-to-heart transmission, he's got it. And then he says, okay, you got it, you can go and teach, right? And so that's particularly, it's particular to Zen and to no other tradition. So that's what makes Zen so simple and unencumbered and immediate as opposed to some other tradition. So then the Buddha just held up a flower and Mahakashya met its heart and the Buddha's heart. No words needed to be spoken. The flower proclaimed the Dharma that resounded throughout the whole universe. So when we quiet our minds and listen with our hearts, the voice of the Buddha resonates everywhere. And I was looking for a poem that would say this. I couldn't really find it, but the best I found was, the valley stream's rippling is indeed the eloquent tongue of Buddha. The mountain's contour is not other than that of the body of Buddha. With the coming of night, I heard the 84,000 songs. That's my talk. That's it. So the talk was more like about experiencing what is without filter. Does that make sense? Like, is that Zen for you, or... am I totally off?
No. So. as soon as you said you're going to speak from your own experience, I was very happy. It really made me happy. Because to me, that is what's here, what's now, rather than being. So I was delighted that you would share your experience with us.
See, there's in the Koan tradition, there is some talks that I've listened to where it says all these eager young monks come to their teachers and say, "What is Buddha? What am I? What is this?" And all they'll respond with is the oak tree in the front garden. That's it. Or they'll say, "Have you eaten? Yes, go wash your bowls." So that is what the thing about Zen that is so amazing, and it's elusive, but it's like almost like you get aligned and then the whole world opens up. Your heart gets aligned and then the whole world opens up. Like, this is like, there's nothing. It's just the oak tree in the garden. That's what the truth is. Like, the flower, the oak tree, I mean, you need to wash your bowls, you know, it's like, there's nothing else, it's just simple.
I like the emphasis on the heart, because in my experience and reading as well, the mind can't grasp what we're doing at all. And we still, there's a mountain of conditioning to sort of get over. And you really have to be in the heart, I think, too.
At least that's been true for me.
Yeah, me too.
Yes.
Excuse me for, you know, kind of backtracking to the beginning of your talk. You were talking about mindfulness, and you tied into that the concept of heart-mind. And I'm really sorry to say I'm unfamiliar with that concept. Could you kind of flesh out more of that?
Well, you know, over the years, I just have been struggling with mindfulness and how to really practice it. You know, like, what is the actual practice of mindfulness? And it didn't seem to transform anything. It just seemed like, okay, pay attention to in the present moment without changing. But that's still a very cerebral activity for me. For me, I think that we all bring our own conditioning, our own what we need for this practice. It shows us. So for me, maybe the practice is showing me you need to go to your heart. You need to. And then it is encouraging to see that the Japanese word is shin, which actually, if you see the kanji for it, it's the actual picture of the heart with the four chambers, the shin. So, okay, that I can do. I can do that. I can be in my heart, you know. I needed that. It makes a difference when I'm fearful or I'm doubtful coming back to the heart. It doesn't happen like that, but it's just slow cultivation, like someone said, you know, like it's sapling. It's a sapling. You just need to nurture it, but nurture it in your heart. And Well, it's
two different things.
That's
one thing.
It's one thing.
It's
one thing. Is it either or? Mm-hmm. It's just a different way to approach. But that's the ambiguity. You know, defines it. It's one thing. It's not physical. It's not emotion.
Well, do we call it that because that feeling seems to come from right here? It comes from here.
Based on some reading I did early on that was very helpful to me about the way the Japanese look at things, and this may come from China, I don't know, but it's my understanding that Shen means heart and mind.
Mm-hmm. Heart, mind.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So a struggle for us in the West is we do everything with our mind.
Yeah.
And when somebody is in a coma, being kept alive, as long as this is going, they're alive. In Japan, as long as this is going, you're alive. When this stops, that's it. So I think of it as all of this, and I even add the horror to it. So to me, it's three things, which I think for Americans might be kind of hard, because we want to know the answer. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Just tell me what to do. So it can be a struggle.
No one can tell you. That's what I found out. No teacher can tell you what's a good practice for you. You just have to find it out yourself. Slowly, painfully, you need to find it out, just like the Buddha did. You got to just figure it out, you know? But I had an interesting experience once when I was at retreat. The teacher said, find where your breath comes from. Is it in your hara? Is it in your chest? Where is the breath? And I was like, what is he talking about? He says, I said, why? He says, because if you find that, you'll find where you are. Now, I don't know what happened, but I was sitting with it. And suddenly, I felt like, wait, I just got filled with this kind of sadness. And like, I don't know what happened. I was sitting there. People thought I had a cold because I'm crying. You know, get a tissue and all of this stuff. And then I went to the teacher and I said, what the heck? I lost my dad a couple of years ago. I don't remember crying like this. I'm just so happy that I'm sad so much, you know? And he looked at me and he smiled and he said, yes, that's what Zen practice can do. It's like you put a cover of protection on yourself. You sit, something opens up. I don't even know if you've heard this, but when it actually happened, really, I went into the kitchen to chop onions. Even the onions were like precious. And so I said to him, don't you once said that somebody at retreat started crying when he saw a can of tomatoes? So then he says, now you know what she was talking about. Like, so it's so mysterious. It's so hard to say, what is this thing that makes us cry when we see a can of tomatoes? You know, for the rational mind, it's like, but that's what they say, that the encounter, the Zen encounter, is a face-to-face, I mean, heart-to-heart. So
I appreciate your quotes and the wisdom you shared, your personal McCullens. And we, in our world, material world, we don't trust what's too simple, because you know, our culture especially, we don't want a simple answer. But human worship, I mean, like in the Kabbalah, it's this, the pillars through the center. It's not an accident in our anatomy that the heart is here, because it connects the hara, the earth, to, you know, the body work I've done from the Kurdish people is, if you need to learn to tie your shoes, you need a mind. But the mind is like a 7-year-old on a car trip in the back seat. So you're the driver. And I appreciate your sharing from your heart.
Thank you.
I love that analogy. That is so perfect.
Are we there yet?
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. Please touched me.
Yeah, there's this Indian person. I saw him on a little video at a And mindfulness, in a way, unfortunately, has become a buzzword.
Mm-hmm.
But that can be good or bad. But there's this Indian, and I saw this little video, and he said, give the mind something to do while you're meditating, even if it's count your breath or, you know, sit straight, because it needs some kind of rules, so to speak. But, I appreciate, you know, kind of your journey sharing today.
It's a long one. Takes forever. I always envy the teachers who've liked have access to this for extended periods of time and then can act from there. But it's also like my karma or my conditioning that makes it so hard, you know. But like I said, we don't have to worry too much, because when she smiled at me, I just smiled back.
Get that fundraising letter for Rama Ray.
Yeah.
Do you remember that words on the little? It's not a not a bookmark, but it's a card.
Yeah.
I set them on my at my meditation altar, and I read them every morning when I sit zazen. But when I try to say them now in my head, I can't do it.
You got it when you send them.
No, it's the end of the year. They say before the end of the year, we just make a donation.
I made a donation. I didn't get that.
Oh. This was what was prompting me to make a donation. But the card that came with it was kind of like a bookmark, but it wasn't. It was bigger than a bookmark, but it had this little quote at the top, and it was something. It was like something like we. Buddha nature is in all of us, and you still have to practice. It's kind of the message that I get from it. So it's like you're already inherently there, but you still have to practice. That's what the practice is all about.
Well, that was the question that led Dogen to China. He was he'd been practicing for many years in China. And then he asked his teachers, so if I'm already the Buddha, why do I need to practice? And nobody answered his question satisfactorily. So that's why he went to, when he was in Japan, and that's why he went to China, met Ru Jing, and he practiced with him and for years before his body and mind dropped away. You know, like, so I think that is the paradox of Zen. You're already the Buddha, but you got to work to figure out that, you know. You're already home, but you have to travel to come back there, you know. But there's one teacher that says that sometimes it helps to remember that, you know, that you are already home, you are already the Buddha. That gives you encouragement for the journey that must be made. Like, don't start on the journey saying, like, I'm going to find. No, when you have that confidence, I think we all do. That's why we're here, right? Like, if you tell yourself over and over again that, no, I know that I am, and then it'll be easier to do the hard work to find yourself back.
I think it says that the realization must be manifested. That's the second part. So you're already there, but the realization must be manifested. I'll bring it next. Mm-hmm. Or post it.
That's it. Anything else? What time do we end? 12, right?
12.
Yeah, so it's 12. Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.